free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net. See our upcoming lineup of speakers as well as our past lineup. Get downloads for the recent as well as archived episodes, and get phone numbers for calling in live if you are listening live. We did postpone today's show for a couple of hours. Today is April 28, 2008, and we have with us the CEO of Earthlink Technologies. His name is Hal Roberts, as well as Joe Parsons, who is vice president of that company. They're going to be talking to us about ground source heat pumps. They've been in the industry for nearly two decades, both residential and commercial systems, to serve preheated air and pre-cooled air in the winter, preheated in the winter, pre-cooled in the summer. I got this written out wrong here on my description. Drawing from the thermal mass of the earth, resulting in significant savings. This is a topic I've been wanting to cover for some time. Thanks for joining us, Hal and Joe.
Thank you, Sterling.
Thank you.
So tell us about ground source heat pumps. Is that the proper name for this technology?
That's one of the names that are commonly used for the technology. The sun stores energy in the earth every day, and we extract that heat from the shallow earth and deliver it to heat homes and small commercial buildings and to provide commercial water heating.
Do you also use it for pre-cooling the air in the summer?
Yes, we can extract heat from a building and reject that heat into the earth.
Okay, that's the opposite of what I described. What I'm envisioning is incoming air being cooled down to the 54, whatever degrees Fahrenheit that the earth is, before you cool it down further with an air conditioning system.
Now, this system not only preheats or pre-cools, it provides the sole source for heating and cooling. The earth temperature in the United States varies from 76 degrees in the far south to the coldest of 42 degrees on the U.S.-Canadian border. That provides a very good, stable temperature to heat in the winter and cool in the summer. The standard refrigerant that is used in any heat pump will boil from a liquid to a vapor at minus 42 degrees Fahrenheit. So the earth is a very good, stable source of heat to deliver heat for buildings or to heat water at any time. As we say, this kind of technology can provide heating anywhere that people live, any time of the day.
Okay. And I notice on your website, the vernacular is geared toward commercial, but you also do residential service. Is that correct?
For homes, we heat and cool space and optionally can provide heating of domestic water. For commercial buildings, for large users of water, we can provide very efficient preheating of water up to 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
Before it goes into the typical boiler?
Or commercial water heater tank, yes.
So what kind of savings are we talking about when we're using a ground source heat pump? And is it what do you call it in your industry?
Ground source heat pump is a broad generic name. That is a good descriptor for this kind of technology. Our specific kind of technology is referred to as direct geo-exchange, because we put the refrigerant line directly in contact with its heat source and heat sink in the earth. We do not have an intermediate water loop, as is typical of many geothermal or ground source heat pumps, because the standard refrigerant line is put in direct contact with the earth. And that way we eliminate the need for a pump to circulate water in a loop in the earth, and we eliminate an intermediate heat exchanger, and thereby can deliver higher efficiency.
Is this something you have patented?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we've received 9 U.S. patents, 10 international patents, and we have 2 applications for patents on additional technology that are now pending in the United States.
So do you consider your system to be the best, or are you near the best in terms of your competitors?
Well, we refer to ourselves as the successful pioneer of direct geo-exchange heat pumps. Inherently, direct geo-exchange systems are more efficient than water-based geothermal systems because they do not require the intermediate heat exchange that I was referring to. Also, part of our patented technology, it is primarily the control of the flow of refrigerants, so that our proprietary refrigerant controls can maximize the operating efficiency of a heat pump throughout the broad range of operating conditions where ambient temperatures may be very high or very low, and also the temperature to be served throughout a wide range can be delivered very efficiently. So we do have proven our ability to perform 25% more efficiently than water-based geothermal heat pumps in field tests 20 years ago in the state of Michigan.
And the typical, the water-based ones, what kind of savings are they giving a customer when they're installed versus what you can give people?
Average efficiency of a water-based geothermal system is in the range of a coefficient of performance of 2.5, which translated means that if you use one unit of electricity, you can deliver 2.5 times that amount of energy into either water or space to be heated. Ours ranges in the vicinity of 3.5 to 4.
Okay. So COP of 3.5 to 4 is what you're getting.
Right.
Now, when you do a sales pitch to a commercial or to a residential customer, what kind of ROI are you telling them they can expect, the return on investment?
Joe Parsons can
elaborate.
Pardon me?
Right. I can add to that. First of all, we need to really clarify whether this would be residential application for space heating and cooling or commercial. On the commercial side, with our commercial water heating product, which might be used if there would be a need for some 2,000 to 2,500 gallons per day of hot water, you can certainly see a payback period in the realm of 2.5 to 3 years for a system with a price tag, an install price of anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000, as you might see with commercial water heating systems. On the residential side, the payback figures will be slightly longer, anywhere from 3 years to 5 years, typically, And what we have found over the years, anytime you have a payback period that is 5 years or less, it seems that the customer will certainly go with that option. We're also talking about a system that has a useful life, geothermal in general, useful life of 20 years plus as compared to 12 to 15 years for an air source heat pump and sometimes even less for a high efficiency natural gas furnace.
Now, when you talk about a 20-year lifetime, and is this something that, what is being replaced at 20 years if they want to refurbish, because obviously a house is going to last longer than that?
Well, and that's not to say that our systems after 20 years would require replacement. The earth loop, which again is the primary cost driver and the reason that geothermal systems cost more than an air source heat pump, for example, is the cost of installing the earth loop. That earth loop would certainly be there and available for, a system that, if it were replaced at 20 or 25 years, you could attach it to that same earth loop.
And how long is the earth loop going to last? Because that can be subject to corrosion, rusting, and things like that.
Well, we use copper as a material for earth loop. Copper is one of the few metals that occurs naturally in the earth. We have, in our history, never had an earth loop failure due to corrosion in some 25 plus years of installation. So we do realize there are certain conditions where the loops might be exposed to a hostile environment. That said, we have a corrosion protection system, a cathodic protection system that actually prohibits corrosion of that earth loop. It's an impressed current type of system, and it feeds a very small milliamp voltage back to the earth loop, so it precludes corrosion.
So when you talk about a 20-year plus lifetime, are you talking about the replacement of what?
We're talking about the compressor unit itself. Our system is a split system. Basically, you have an earth loop, you have a compressor unit, and you have an air handler, or in the situation where we're making hot water for in-floor radiance, you have a heat exchanger for that purpose. So the useful life, again, is based around the compressor unit itself. The compressor unit consists of our refrigerant management controls and a refrigeration compressor, with the compressor being really the only moving part within the system, the only thing that would be subject to failure over time. The life cycle being 20 to 25 years, is primarily because the system is operating within a really tight set of parameters. With the earth temperature being stable, that system is, we try to equate it to, it's almost like a refrigerator in your house. That refrigerator is operating under controlled conditions, and you've certainly seen refrigerators that last, 15 to 20 years. So it's because that system is not having to operate under the harsh conditions as with an air source heat pump. You have a compressor that's required to operate when the temperatures in the summer could be in excess of 100 degrees and the winter could be as low as, zero or minus 10. So our compressor is operating under a controlled set of conditions where it's seeing the ambient earth temperature, which is somewhere in the 55 degree range.
How much does the earth temperature vary in one given spot, summer versus winter?
That, again, is subject to its geographical location. The average ground temperature is usually also the average air temperature for any given area. You will see some temperature deflection over the winter and over the summer, but we've taken that into consideration when we designed our system applications tables. We know that a compressor, for example, a 4-ton nominal compressor at startup in the heating mode will certainly provide more than 4 tons of capacity, you know, as much as 5 tons of capacity. We also know that that system at its design temperature conditions might also provide less than 4 tons of capacity. We, taking this information that we have accumulated over the years, we have been able to set up a set of applications tables that allow us to accurately estimate the operating cost of that system based on its output performance.
Would you say that every home that's built ought to have one of these, and every business ought to have this?
I would certainly say so. We're seeing a trend now in the industry with the growing popularity of more energy-efficient building products, structural insulated panels, insulated concrete forms, especially window products, high-performance insulation. That combined with the geothermal system just makes sense. By going with
like building a home without insulation, building a home without tapping into the earth's ambient heat to reduce your bill for heating and cooling, just makes sense.
Well, that's true, and as I was saying, if you incorporate not only those when you incorporate the energy efficient building materials, you are reducing the amount of heat pump required. So, in the past, as a rule of thumb, you might have seen, 400 to 600 square feet per ton of capacity. We're seeing structures these days that'll, can certainly handle almost 1,000 square feet per ton of capacity, which means when you're installing our heat pump system, you can substantially reduce the amount of capacity and also the install cost of that system.
So when, let's just talk about the politics here for a second. If I understand right, building codes exist, and when I'm building a new home, I'm not going to pass off on my building code unless I have insulation built into the walls and into the roof. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So, what kind of headway might be made to add to the list of building code requirements a ground source heat pump system?
I consider that is unlikely that they would require the selection of particular equipment to achieve that objective, because that would in effect be precluding some products from the market.
Right. Well, I'm not specifying your product. I'm specifying the general technology, the idea of tying into the earth's ambient temperature to pre-cool in the summer and to preheat in the winter.
Right. Well, I don't envision any government of the United States requiring the use of a specific class of technology, which, for example, would be geothermal heat pumps. That would exclude the use of other types of technologies, for example, solar for heating or ventilation for cooling or natural gas.
If you see using solar for heating, it would make your solar heater more efficient if you're heating preheated air through the ground. So your solar heater is more effective if you're also incorporating the ambient ground temperature and whatever name came up. I mean, at some point, the U.S. government added to the building code the need for insulation. And what I'm saying is with the increased awareness by the population of the need to be more efficient, to use our resources more wisely, and in this case, you actually save money, why wouldn't the government say, okay, we'll add to our shopping list of requirements for a new home some kind of ambient ground access or, you know, whatever they want to call it, they call, in the wall, they call that insulation. What would you call the stuff that would be harnessing the ground in temperature? And add that to the shopping list of requirements.
It certainly is on the shopping list, but it's not the only item on the shopping list. That was the point I was trying to make. The government establishes performance standards for the building envelope and for the efficiency of the equipment that you select, but they don't say you must use a particular class of equipment or type, brand or type of equipment.
Right, and I'm not advocating a specific type or specific brand, but I am advocating a specific class of technology that it just makes sense that every home ought to, and every business ought to, every new business, new home built ought to incorporate this technology. It saves them money and it saves electricity.
I fully agree with you. It's just the legislative approach to achieving the goal of efficiency is where I'm differing a little bit.
Are you saying it takes time, or what are you saying?
No, I don't think it takes time. The point is the government is not going to say to achieve a certain level of efficiency, you must use this class of heating equipment.
Mm-hmm. How are you doing on the awareness? I mean, how many Americans, for example, know about this class of technology? Not yours in particular, but the class of technology.
That's a very good point. Awareness is a major challenge for new entrants with technology into this very established field of space heating and cooling. We're accustomed, historically, to heating originally with wood firing, then with coal, and later using fossil fuel products from the earth, gas and natural gas and oil, and then later nuclear. Our technology is newer. Our specific technology has only been around 28 years, but fortunately for us, the Internet exists, and people from around the world are searching for energy efficiency and reliable means of using renewable energy. And when they do that, they often find us on the Internet and then contact us. But it is a challenge to introduce new technology and create awareness of the product. We're gaining on it, and the Internet is a major tool that enables us to broaden awareness.
Certainly
with increasing energy costs and environmental concerns, more people are searching, and more people like you and your organization are increasing awareness of alternative solutions which are proven.
Right, and that's one thing about this technology, this interview, that kind of makes a little different. We typically are covering things that are coming down the pike. Typically there are existing prototypes, but it's kind of cutting teeth, whereas this is an industry that's been around for a couple of decades.
Yes.
It's proven, it's well established, especially in Europe. From what I understand, they're about a decade ahead of us in implementation over there. Would you agree with that statement?
They are more energy aware and concerned, and as a result of that, this geothermal technology has met broad acceptance. And the primary reason is that their energy costs have exceeded ours for many years.
Mm-hmm. Is your company in particular over in Europe right now?
Yes, we have product operating in 14 countries and 41 states at this point. Not in the volume that we would prefer right now, but it is expanding rather quickly.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that your growth is linear or logarithmic or somewhere in between?
We doubled sales in 2006, but this housing and mortgage crisis, which is not limited to the United States, had its effect in the year 2007. But as energy prices increase and concern for the environment continues to grow, certainly the interest and the purchase of our product is growing also.
Well, let's talk about something. We're not just involved in new home implementation. You also do retrofits. And let's talk about the what's involved in a retrofit for a residential and a commercial unit, both in terms of cost, return on investment, as well as the actual logistics of coming into a residence, for example, and retrofitting a ground source heat pump technology.
I think we're certainly uniquely suited for the retrofit market for residential product. As Hal mentioned earlier, our technology is direct exchange technology. That means to us and to the end user that, as we said, we're using a highly conductive earth loop made of copper tube. And since our conductivity rate through our earth loop is much higher, that means that we can install less earth loop per ton of capacity. For example, with water source product that uses polyethylene pipe, typically 250 to 300 linear feet of tube per ton of capacity, or borehole basically per ton of capacity is required. Our systems operate with a minimum of 100 feet and a maximum of 150 linear feet per ton of capacity. So that said, we can certainly be installed for less money because we're in reducing the amount of drilling requirement. But also, our loops are very compact. As a comparison against a water source system, they're usually installed in boreholes of anywhere from 5 to 8 inches in diameter, depending on the drilling technology available. And usually that's large drilling equipment that you would equate to the equipment that's used for water well drilling. Our system can be installed in a borehole that's 2.5 to 3 inches in diameter. We have worked over the years to develop an infrastructure of drillers throughout the United States and also with drill manufacturers to create specifically designed technology that is small, compact. There are machines out there that are that could certainly fit through a 4 foot wide opening, basically through the garden gate into the backyard, and quickly and efficiently drill holes and even drill these holes out diagonally so that the earth loops come back to a central manifold point and thereby impacting a very small amount at the surface.
So let's say, for example, I'm here in Utah. I've got my water line for the irrigation of my yard out there, and I'm going to have you come in and install a ground source heat pump. What's involved in terms of, let's just walk me through the process of cost, of time involved, of drilling, how deep you go. I've got a 3,500 square foot home basement, and we're in Utah. Climate is, we turn our air conditioner on through the summer. I'm actually using a quasi ground source heat pump right now. We have an unfinished basement, and I turn off the return air vents upstairs, and I have all my air go through my basement and come. I use the pump on my heater in the wind in the summer to pre-cool the air. So I don't even have to turn on my air conditioner except like later in the summer after, and you know, the basement started to warm up by then, but I just used a cool basement to cool my upstairs through most of the summer. And that's the same principle that we're talking about with yours, except rather than using an unfinished basement, you're just tapping into the cool air or the cool ground temperature around a home, around a business, to pre-cool the air in the winter. But let's talk about the situation here. What would be involved to come in and retrofit my house?
Well, the first step in any installation is an accurate load calculation, determining the amount of BTUs required to be delivered to the house in the winter and the amount of BTUs that require to be extracted from that house in the summer. You'd mentioned pre-cooling before, and I think to better explain exactly how our system works. Ours is a refrigerant-based system and uses a refrigerant that is compressed by a refrigeration compressor. That refrigerant, as Hal mentioned, would boil from a liquid to a vapor at minus 42 degrees. So what we're trying to do here is really affect a heat or phase change in that refrigerant. If you would imagine the system operating in the heating mode, we compress the refrigerant with the compressor, and as we do, we create a hot refrigerant gas. We send that hot gas to an air handler or to a refrigerant-to-water heat exchanger, and thereby heat that medium. We'll heat the air, and we can heat the air to, you know, something in the range of 110 degrees Fahrenheit. As we heat the air, we're drawing the cool return air over that coil, and it's causing the refrigerant gas to go from a hot gas to begin to condense into a liquid refrigerant. We send that refrigerant through one of our patented flow controls, which further drops the pressure of that refrigerant and causes it to change phase to a liquid. So we're ending up sending that cold liquid refrigerant out to the earth loop, and this refrigerant may be certainly below zero Fahrenheit as it goes to the earth loop. The earth temperature in your area, for example, is going to be in the, you know, in the 55 to 60 degree range. That's enough heat in the earth to cause the refrigerant to change its phase from a liquid back to a vapor. We bring that vapor back to the compressor to start the cycle over again. We do just the opposite in the cooling mode. We will send that hot vapor refrigerant out to the earth loop. This vapor may be, you know, 130, 140 degrees Fahrenheit. It can give up its heat to the surrounding earth. Certainly that 55 degree earth temperature is cool enough to cause that refrigerant to condense back to a liquid. We then bring the liquid refrigerant back to the compressor unit through our refrigerant management system, where it's converted to a very cold liquid refrigerant, and we send that to the air handler and create cool air for the space. So, again, it's a bit different from the pre-cooling concept, but what we're doing, we're using the earth, again, that stable heat source of the earth to cause a phase change in the refrigerant, as opposed to what you would see with an air source heat pump, for example. An air source heat pump loses its efficiency in the cooling mode as the outdoor temperature gets higher. It also loses its efficiency in the heating mode as the temperature gets lower. So that allows us to actually use that stable temperature of the earth so that we're always operating in a very efficient mode.
Do you have some kind of a diagram, an animation on your website that describes this process?
We do. There are two diagrams, one that illustrates the function in the heating mode and also gives an indication of the changing temperatures based on the color of the animation of the lines.
Okay. Yeah, I plan on doing a feature page on your company to put on our testwiki.com website.
Okay.
And I'll look for that. And,
you'd also mentioned a retrofit. There is a very good PowerPoint illustration of an installation that was done in Portland, Oregon several years ago. I'd mentioned the 4 foot wide drilling equipment. This particular drilling machine was entered the backyard between the homeowner's fence and the side of his garage. This particular backyard, I think, was about 35 feet wide and only about 18 feet deep, so it's a very tight installation, yet the drilling equipment was able to fit there. They were able to drill diagonally and bring everything back to a central manifold point, and the drilling for that project took certainly less than 2 days, and now that the installation is complete, you would not know that geothermal loops were installed, you know, in the backyard of this residence.
What do you do when people have water pipes installed for their watering system?
Yeah, in that situation, well, as I mentioned, the load calculation first before drilling starts, you certainly need to call and locate all the subterranean lines, water lines, phone lines, power lines, potentially, just as part of, you know, good general drilling practices. But again, if we're drilling though diagonally, we're bringing everything back to this central point, which, you know, is a circle and no more than 8 feet in diameter. So there's specialty drilling equipment that can do that, and we're again impacting a very minimal amount of space at the surface.
Mm-hmm. So you're able to how much do you move the drilling rig around the backyard to do different holes? Do you have it in one spot and drill in different directions and it's done?
It depends. It certainly depends upon the number of loops that are installed. We have loops that are 100 foot loops that go into 100 foot boreholes, in one or one and a half loops per ton increments. We also have 75 foot earth loops that are installed two loops per ton, and for scenarios where you may say, for example, you might have a, you know, rock ledge at a certain depth, we have 50 foot earth loops that install diagonally, will penetrate below the surface, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 feet. So by going in a 45 degree angle, not only do we stay above potential obstacles, but we also are increasing the footprint of that earth loop. You can imagine we're attaching it to a much greater overall area if we install it diagonally than if we do vertically.
Mm-hmm. Is there equipment that can identify, for example, the water piping for an irrigation, the ground watering system?
I'm sure that equipment exists. I have personally never seen it, though.
Sterling, typically the irrigation equipment is installed in a grid, and you go and locate where the sprinkler head is, and several of them, so that you know a space that's within the square that forms, that it is safe to drill and not penetrate those.
Okay. So the drilling takes a couple of days, and you run your holes down. Are you shooting straight down and then tying them together at the top?
That's right. That's right.
Well, they manifold as if it were a cone in the earth, so that they converge at a manifold at the surface of the earth. That's where Joe was talking about. The manifold pit does not exceed 8 feet in diameter.
And when you say a manifold pit, this is something that is going to be buried underneath the ground and not going to be protruding above the ground when it's done?
That's right. Correct.
Okay. And then you run that where? Into the basement where the water heater is? Where do you maintain your other equipment?
The equipment itself is rated for outdoor installation. It's certainly designed to be weatherproof. I would venture to say, though, that 80% of the systems that are sold actually go inside a basement, inside a garage, that type of scenario. That way you have no outdoor equipment whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. From the manifolds, let's say manifolds because there are two, each earth loop has an entry and an exit point. There will be one manifold for the liquid refrigerant. There will be one manifold for the vapor side. So all the earth loops are connected to the two manifolds. Then two tubes are routed back underground to the equipment itself, to the compressor unit.
Now, when you talk about a loop, I'm picturing an in and an out. So in, when I look at a diagram on your website, I see these little spikes going out in the shape of a cone, and it looks like there's just a single spike, but each one of those holes has an out and an in?
That's correct. That's correct. The as I said, the refrigerant enters, depending upon the mode, either as a liquid refrigerant or as a vapor refrigerant. So it really depends upon the mode as to the flow direction through that loop, but you're absolutely right. Each loop, each 100-foot borehole, for example, would actually house 200 linear feet of copper tube.
Right. Okay, well, let's talk about price. What is a retrofit going to look like for a typical home?
You know, that's something that varies based on geography, again, and the cost of labor and materials within a given area. I can give you the global overview here of systems in the United States. The average cost for, on the low end, for a geothermal system, and I'm talking really geothermal in general now, not just our particular product, on the low end will be somewhere in the range of, you know, $4,500 per ton to $5,000 per ton. There are installations and there are contractors out there that are actively selling systems in the $6,000 to $7,000 per ton range. But again, it really depends upon the equipment. The cost of drilling is the major driver for that equation.
For the lay person, again, what, when you say per ton, what does that mean?
Ton is terminology for 12,000 BTUs of capacity. So, for example, if your system requirement is an air conditioner that you need to be able to reject 36,000 BTUs, then that would be a three-ton system. A typical window air conditioner, for example, maybe a half ton or maybe even one and a half tons of capacity. So, again, one and a half tons, 18,000 BTUs. So, again, you know, if we're talking about a residence that's 3,000 square feet, as a retrofit, you're probably going to need a four, maybe even a five-ton system. It really depends on how much attention is spent to upgrading not only the heat pump itself, but also insulation, making the home more weathertight. We always recommend spending additional money to make the structure more efficient. Thereby, you can install less capacity. It lowers your install cost for the system, and ultimately reduces your operating cost as well.
Now, when you're doing a retrofit, are you tying into the existing HVAC system?
That's certainly possible. If it's, say, for example, you're replacing an air source heat pump, as long as that ductwork is adequately insulated and sealed, then it's certainly feasible to use that. If you're replacing a gas furnace, for example, then more than likely that ducting will need to be replaced because ducting for a gas furnace is typically smaller in diameter than you would have with an air source heat pump. Our systems are compatible with the air handlers of many manufacturers. There are a few minor changes that need to be made because of the nature of our refrigerant controls, but generally we're compatible. We do not manufacture air handlers. We use the air handlers that are built by companies like Trane and York. So we're certainly compatible with those devices. That's one of the things that needs to be evaluated, though, when the salesman would come in and do a walk through the home, take measurements for the load calculation, and then survey the existing equipment.
So while some homes would be better suited, would have a lower return on investment because they're maybe lower hanging fruit, so to speak, and other homes might be more difficult to retrofit, would you say that any home is suitable for retrofitting? It's just a matter of, pushing back the return on investment.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk for a second about as a business, your website. We've not given up that website domain name yet. That's earthlinked.com, is that correct?
Yes. We actually have two websites now. We have an ecrtech.com and an earthlink.com. We'll soon have consolidated both of those websites into one. The earthlink.com right now is dedicated to the commercial water heating product, and the ecrtech.com is primarily dedicated to the residential space heating and cooling products.
Uh-huh. They are interlinked, however.
So right, they are interlinked.
If you go to earthlink.com, you can get to the other. That will be the sole surviving name eventually.
And if somebody wants to see if you have an installer locally, you have some kind of a dealer locator map in the upper right-hand corner, I see.
That's right.
Are there any places in the United States that you don't service?
There are certainly open areas now. We go to market through what we term sales reps. These are companies that purchase product directly from us and resell it to the installation contractor. In areas where we have no rep coverage, however, we do sell product directly to the installer. So there are certainly some areas where we have little coverage and would certainly like to have more, but if you go to the dealer locator and find there's no company listed, it will give you a link directly back to us at Earthlink Technologies.
What about internationally? Are there any places where you will not or are not yet able to handle customer inquiries or people who want to purchase product?
We can handle customer inquiries from anywhere. We sell only through trained, authorized installers, so we don't sell directly to the homeowner.
Okay.
It requires a capable refrigeration technician, who is capable of handling heat pumps and has had our specific training for our system. There's some areas of the world where we've chosen not to serve at this point in time because of risks to the technology itself, intellectual property protection, specifically China. We've been approached by six companies so far from China wanting to distribute our product, and we have opted not to expose it to that risk at this point.
I see on your list of locate a dealer thing you have about 12 international countries represented in Canada and then all the states in the United States.
Yes. Well, there's some smaller countries in Northern Europe, for example, that are served by one sales rep. For example, Estonia. The sales rep there serves not only Estonia, but Latvia, Lithuania, and Ukraine. And beginning this summer, we'll sell into Russia.
All right. What would you say would be a situation that maybe is on the, we talked about low-hanging fruit, and maybe just quickly we could describe what would you consider a low-hanging fruit on the residential side, commercial side, and what would you consider to be a high birth fruit that's hard to get to? In other words, if you've got such and such a system, it's less indicated than if you've got, you know, the low-hanging fruit type of system. Joe, do you want to address that?
Giving that some thought. You know, from the standpoint of low-hanging fruit, I think that, again, areas that have seen tremendous increases in the cost of fuel recently would certainly be targets. We're seeing just an overwhelming number of inquiries from New England, New York State now that really more than any other part of the country. And I think that's driven by the cost of electricity being high and also the cost of the alternative fuel, which may or may not be natural gas. Certainly there's an extreme amount of escalation in the cost of natural gas, but there are many residential and commercial applications there that still use fuel oil. And when you're seeing oil prices approaching $4 per gallon, and certainly fuel oil approaching $4 per gallon, then all of a sudden that decision to spend the extra money for our system, that's not a barrier anymore. I think that, you know, to address the more unreachable installations, I would have to say that possibly, you know, sale to the government is still in that category. You know, military housing, for example, has always been a goal, and we're certainly approaching those markets now, but it seems to be a very much more difficult sale. Obviously, it's a lot more work to sell that system, but once you sell that system, you're not selling a single system. You're, you know, selling hundreds or thousands of installations for a given project.
May I add to that and say the low-hanging fruit is the motivated customer. People are motivated by a desire to save energy and the cost of energy and to save the environment. Cost is the primary driving factor, and the customers are motivated when they have a large heating demand. For example, Joe mentioned in our case New England and New York State. They have a high heating demand. They also have a high cost of competitive means of delivering heat, so that they're looking for alternatives. They begin to seek us out. The higher hanging fruit, more difficult to reach, would be a very mild climate like San Diego, California. And if you were to combine that with low competitive means of heating and cooling, low energy cost for that service, then that would be a more difficult customer to demonstrate the need to make that purchase.
Mm-hmm. Well, your technology is a good example of a principle that I try and drive home, and that is that renewable energy is coming down in price, and it's not just becoming something to save the environment, but it's actually something that saves your pocketbook as well. And while your technology is going to be an initial capital outlay to do the installation, the return on investment is short enough that it seems like it ought to be appealing to a much broader audience than is presently there. And I would imagine it's just a matter of awareness and getting the word out to let people know that this is a very plausible, reasonable approach to energy conservation.
Very true.
I think it has to do with terminology in the heating and cooling industry. For years and years, and the term high efficiency has been used rather loosely, even in the day of 10-SEER air source heat pumps. If you were to look on the label, they were still labeled as high efficiency products. And while they may be more efficient than electric resistance for heating, they're certainly nowhere near the efficiency level of, you know, an earth-coupled type of system. It was only in early 2007 that the U.S. government mandated the use of a 13-SEER air source heat pump, and I think that says a lot. I think it is totally tied to consumer awareness. If the consumer knows there are products on the market that are more than twice as efficient as, you know, an air source heat pump, then I think they will do their homework, learn about the product, be it ours or any other system out there that offers those efficiency levels, and make that purchase decision. We find that our customer or the end user is a very well-informed consumer, and they go to our website, they learn about our product, and are already pre-sold before they first contact the installation contractor. So, again, I think it comes back to awareness.
Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen, appreciate you joining us today. We've been talking to Jerry Wilson was going to talk to us, and he passed the baton over to Joe Parsons and CEO Hal Roberts. We appreciate you taking the time to explain your system. They're with EarthLink Technologies Incorporated, and you can go to their website at ecrtech.com or earthlinked.com, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Again, thank you for explaining your system, and we wish you the best.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.